Okay, the next argued case is number 14-1613, Ivera Medical Corporation against Hospira Incorporated. Mr. Gross.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Obviousness is a question of law, but it depends on underlying facts. And here, the record shows there are material factual disputes that precluded summary judgment. What we're asking this court to do is allow us to go to trial and have a jury decide the underlying facts, which is what should occur in an obviousness case when there's underlying factual disputes.
Did the district court rely on the two declarations to deny summary judgment?
The district court mentioned two declarations. It was interesting because the court said they were presented in a conclusory fashion. I believe what the district court was getting at, Your Honor, was that the briefing was very short, not that the declarations themselves were conclusory. The declarations actually have a fair amount of detail. So the district court was aware of two declarations. We put declarations in the record, Your Honor, but there wasn't a lot of
analysis. Was there any objection to the declarations?
No, Your Honor.
To the admissibility or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think we're in the situation where there was sometimes in summary judgment there's admissibility objections that the court rules on. But here the court did not throw those out on any admissibility issues. So they are in the record and they were before the court. And in fact, that raises the first material issue of fact, which is KSR and the TriMed decision of the Federal Circuit make clear that when we're talking about whether there's an apparent reason to combine, two of the core fact questions are the following. Whether there's a trend in the relevant design community at the time of invention is a fact issue. And that's for the fact finder. Is there a trend in the relevant design community? Another one is, what's the background knowledge of one of skill in the art? What's going on at the time? And here we have four declarants presented to the district court that said the trend in the relevant design community was going away from venting of a disinfectant cap. That was the trend.
I don't remember all of the details. I thought that some, at least, put aside, I guess, Mr. Huang, is that how one says it? His declaration for a minute. That the other ones were pretty clearly about something different, not about cats, but about keeping a tight liquid seal on fluid ducts. And that's not this.
Your Honor, before the district court, and we talked in the oral argument for summary judgment at A1062, we made that point that the court is bringing up right now. We said the testimony of the experts is that a person skilled in the art didn't want to vent at the time. That's what Lenzing says, Buckman says, Morrison says, and Huang said. At least one of those was an actual disinfecting cap, Your Honor. The other one was art that was being considered.
That's Huang.
Yes, and the other one was art that was
being... And he just has, I'm sorry, one sentence, right, that declares that, is that right?
Well, he says it was his understanding at the time of the invention that a person of ordinary skill in the art wanted a fluid-tight seal. Mr. Lenzing then raises that with the medical instruments that attach to people generally. And then we look at prior art references like Mr. Buckman, and Mr. Buckman says something similar. When you put it all together, Your Honor, and you...
Well, the question...
Go ahead, Your Honor.
This is, I guess, what I'm... You know this prior art better than I, so my impression could be wrong. Tell me why this impression is wrong, that perhaps nothing but that Huang sentence is actually on point, that the other three are about a sufficiently different situation, keeping a line in which fluid is going to be flowing, tightly sealed. That's not what this is, in which case one can't put it all together. One would have to rely on the sufficiency of Mr. Huang's assertion alone. So tell me everything that's wrong with what I just described.
Well, Your Honor, I guess we'd want to stay in the world of apples and apples. If we're going to say that the pertinent art is Huang, because that's a disinfecting cap that has a sponge in it, and that's the art that we're talking about here, then the question is how many concentric circles do you want to go away? We had four declarants who said as you go away in concentric circles, you have a situation where the understanding of one of skill in the art with respect to seals is that it should be fluid tight. And the court's question is, all right, well, what if we were to narrow the concentric circles down to just disinfecting caps like Huang? Then we would say, understood, that's what we do. Then we would look to white, and white is a fluid seal, so that's also tight. And then the question would be, when we now talk about combining devices, what's the relevancy of Chin Loy? And the question would be none, because Chin Loy is not a disinfecting cap. Chin Loy is sending gas into a machine and has nothing to do with a disinfecting cap. So the point for the court is, if the court was going to have a narrow definition of what is the relevant art, then the court's point is well taken, Your Honor, that we have Huang and we have Lensing talking generally and other declarants talking more generally, Your Honor. But it would also then be not make any sense to say someone should look for Chin Loy as a helpful reference. And I do want to say – go ahead, Your Honor.
Can I
ask
this? Is it contested in the evidence that if somebody wanted to vent a catheter cap, that they would have looked to the combination of Huang and Chin Loy?
It's absolutely contested in the sort of wall of pertinent art. Actually, going back to Your Honor's original question, one would not look at Chin Loy because Chin Loy is not a medical cap that has a sponge or fluid. Chin Loy is actually a completely different purpose. Chin Loy has a tortuous pathway where you inject gas inside a machine. You don't want to inject fluid inside a medical cap into the catheter. That's actually the opposite of what you want to do. And so we say, Dr. Lensing, and also Mr. Huang says that actually would frustrate the purpose to take Chin Loy. And going back to the court's original question, Chin Loy is farther away than Huang or the invention. Just like the court saying, well, where should we draw the line? Chin Loy is far away. And our point is, if the convention as from four witnesses is you don't want venting, you want a fluid-tight seal, understanding we're viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to us, that's where we are because it's summary judgment and it's a clear and convincing evidence standard, then the question is, all right, well, what if you have Chin Loy? And we're saying Chin Loy, their channel or pathway, they go from the interior of the housing to the exterior of the cap. So they're not talking about trying to help out with the pressure buildup inside a cap. They have nothing to do with that. They're not talking about a fluid and trying to evaporate a fluid because it's a gas.
Was the problem of pressure in a cap known before your invention?
Your Honor...
Is the pressure that occurs during the process of putting the cap on, or is there pressure built up even once the cap is on?
It's pressure putting the cap on creates the pressure, and then you have to deal with it.
So, I mean, you had, is it Mr. Rogers? Is that the name?
Yes, Your Honor.
He said something quite like this was a known problem.
Your Honor, a person of ordinary skill in the art, if you are trying to figure out what was happening is people were saying, the understanding of skill, looking in the light most favorable to us, is the design community is saying we want a fluid tight seal. And they're not having success. It's been 20 years. There hasn't been any major success in the field. Our invention comes along and says, fluid tight seal, no, we're going to have a vent. And what happens? Extreme success in the marketplace. So
at least for now, I'd like to keep the so-called objective indicia separate from one sort of motivation to combine piece of logic. If it was true that there was a known problem of pressure with caps, and therefore a skilled artisan would have been motivated to look for a way to relieve the pressure using a cap, why isn't there a motivation to vent?
Sure. Thank you, and I'm sorry. If we look at whether there was a known problem with pressure in the cap, it's not the case that the prior art is identifying this known pressure, this known problem. So we're not looking at prior art and saying, we're not in a situation where the prior art is screaming out, there's this pressure problem, what are we going to do about it? That's not where we are, Your Honor. Where we are is a person of ordinary skill in the art was aware that this hadn't been working for years. I don't mean to suggest this is I'm going ahead. I'm just saying that's what the situation was. So we're not in a situation where the prior art is screaming out, what are we going to do about this pressure buildup? Instead, we're in a situation where the invention was fluid tight seal is now going to have this release of pressure, and it's going to allow this evaporation. And that was the inventive concept. And so now the court's asking, well, okay, let's say a person of ordinary skill in art was able to figure out that maybe the problem that this hasn't worked for so long has something to do with pressure buildup.
And maybe even Mr. Rogers acknowledged that.
Well, I think we're not – I can take a look at the record exactly, but I'm not comfortable saying Mr. Rogers has said that a person of ordinary skill in the art specifically has acknowledged pressure buildup. I apologize, Your Honor.
Okay,
I'll take a look at that. But what I wanted to say, Your Honor, was even to the extent a person of ordinary skill in the art starts thinking about pressure buildup or evaporation, there are other means to address pressure buildup that don't involve eliminating the fluid-tight seal. And we have that in the record, that you could make the cap bigger on the inside and that you could also have a certain type of material. There are other things you could do. And our point was we want to go to the jury and argue that because Chinloy has nothing to do with this art and is not helpful, and because white is a fluid-tight seal, so white is not at all helpful, that a person of ordinary skill in the art would have nowhere to look, no answer to find, and so that person would do these other options that we have. And it's a clear fact dispute that experts should be able to fight over.
Can I ask you a record question about the objective indicia matter? Was there evidence from either side about whether there were ventless caps on the market that were being used or that were tried and failed? Because obviously your product, I gather, the evidence is at least clear enough for a triable issue on the commercial success of the product. Then the question is, what's it attributable to? And it might matter whether it's being compared to no caps versus ventless caps. And so I wanted to know, what was the state of the record about the state of the world with respect to ventless caps?
I believe, Your Honor, that there was some evidence in the record that there had been some caps that had not succeeded. There's an invention called Minahay, I think. I hope I'm not getting it wrong.
Say that again?
Minahay, I think, is the invention. I can get the spelling right. But there was some prior art that didn't have the vent, and nothing had been commercially successful. And, Your Honor, where we are in terms of moving on to after we get past the fact that there's a raging debate about the state of knowledge of a person of ordinary skill in the art, which we've just talked about briefly, where we're saying the state of knowledge of a person of art was to go against venting in favor of a fluid-tight seal, and we have four declarants on that. The next point is there's a raging fight about what does the reference teach, which is a fact issue that should go to the jury, and we disagree with each other about what White teaches and what Chinloy teaches, and there's a raging fight about whether the function of Chinloy is relevant or not. So there's all these raging factual disputes that the district court resolved against us, even though it's summary judgment. When you get to secondary factors, as a check on hindsight, it's clear that we are in danger of hindsight here, Your Honor. And the reason we're in danger of hindsight is that this commercial product that has the venting and has everything else, so the full breadth of the invention, the claimed product has every single feature of the claims, full breadth, went from zero to 300,000 to 10 million to 100 million in the first few years because it revolutionized how things were done in hospitals, revolutionized. And to point Your Honor's question, there's no evidence in the record that there was a successful, you know, very successful product that preceded it. It was really one of the cutting edge products. Whatever had happened before had failed. And under this court's precedent, if we can come forward and say we have an inventive product and it falls within the claim, then that creates a presumption that it's based on the product. In other words, Iveria's marketed product embodies the claimed features of the invention.
Well, our precedent is perhaps not quite as clear and uniform as it might be. There certainly are cases, as you say, that don't require the patent owner to come forward with affirmative evidence of what the success is attributable to, but at least like the Tokay case, points in the opposite direction.
If I may quibble with Your Honor for just a moment.
Please.
Even when the Federal Circuit seems to be giving a little wiggle room, it still will usually cite this proposition from Brown and Williamson. It'll say that if a product is coincidental with the claim features, then the burden shifts to the defendant. In other words, that's a well-cited proposition. It's not one case that we kind of found in an attic somewhere. It's a well-stated proposition that if a marketed product embodies all the claimed features of the invention, and its product is coextensive with the claimed features, the burden shifts to the defendant. But Judge Toronto, what I do want to point out is in this case, the other side is not arguing nexus. In other words, they're not saying, we want to tell the court what the evidence is of what the alternative explanation is for this product, this exciting invention that revolutionized what happened in hospitals. Infections went down 85%. That's our unexpected result. 85% in one study that's in the record based on this invention of blood infections. The reduction in blood infections was 85%. And this had been going on for 20 years that they've been studying what to do. They tried cap valves. They tried swabbing. That wasn't working. When this invention came, unexpected results. And, Your Honor, to your point, nowhere did they come forward and say, I know that was for 20 years they're having problems, and I know literally people were dying, and I know after this product came out, there was an 85% reduction in one study, which is in the record, and I know that this went from zero to 100 million in a few years and basically has revolutionized the care of people and helped you with infections.
You wouldn't kind of expect their declarations.
Can I just make this point that on summary judgment,
I thought that they were contesting.
They should be saying that, Your Honor, though. They should be saying, in the light most favorable, all that's true. They should not be contesting what I just said. What I just said is in the record, and we get the entitlement of the light most favorable to us on summary judgment. So they should be saying that's all true for purposes of summary judgment, but then they add this. We have another explanation, and it's this. And then they put it out, and they don't do that.
From the other side.
Sorry,
Your Honor. We'll save you some rebuttal time. Mr. Hess.
Good morning, Your Honor. To address that last point that was being discussed, prior to this invention, prior to the introduction of the Curos cap by Ivera, there was no ventless cap, if you will, in the market. What all the comparison is, and what it goes to, is the bare swabbing of the site on the end of the lure-activated valve on the end of a catheter that goes into the body.
Did anybody try to put a ventless cap on the market, even enough to see that after 10 uses it was a bad idea?
There was one ventless cap that was marketed several years before that. It had some problems with the design of the valve, though. The problems for that were not with the design of the cap itself. It was a bad valve. And so they stopped marketing that valve, and that company stopped marketing the cap that went with that valve. But all the studies that Ivera points to and all the comparisons they make are not with the cap that's shown in the Hong patent. They're with simple wiping of the end of the valve that goes into the catheter that goes into your body. And when they talk about a fluid-tight seal, the fluid-tight seal is important on the end of the valve that's on the end of the catheter. The fluid-tight seal on the cap is not the issue. Whether the cap is ventless or whether it has a vent, there still will be a fluid-tight seal on the valve. Even before caps were used, the valve just stuck out of your arm. It was a fluid-tight seal. And so this desire to have a fluid-tight seal is with regard to the valve, not with regard to the cap itself.
Was there evidence presented to rebut the four declarations, the Hahn declaration, for example?
There was evidence submitted by our expert, Mr. Sheehan, but with regard to the declarations, not all of them were actually...
What did your expert say with respect to the teaching away aspect of the Hahn Declaration?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
What did your expert say with respect to the teaching away aspect of the Hahn Declaration?
The Hahn Declaration goes to an aspect of the cap that was not even contemplated by Hahn at the time, and that...
That's what he's saying. He's saying at the time, we didn't contemplate vents because the object was to prevent any type of, to have a tight seal. And it might, when I look at the Hahn Declaration, I just don't see a sentence. I see several paragraphs where he says that.
Mr. Sheehan points out that in the Hahn device or in the Hahn patent, to the extent there is a seal, the seal is, if you will, a face seal. The threads are not what the sealing device. The threads are not what seals the cap. And so the Hahn device or any of the caps, when you crank them down, there will be a seal on the face, but not on the threads themselves. What we need to look at here is what is not in dispute. What is not in dispute is that the Hahn patent includes all the limitations except venting. What is not in dispute is the level of ordinary skill in the art. What's not in dispute is that the prior art contained disinfecting caps and venting caps. What's not in dispute is
that... And by prior art there, you mean documents. You don't mean, except for this one failed product, right. An actual product. In the
prior art patents and publications. It's not in dispute that the Chinloy reference discloses a vented cap. They may dispute that it goes to a different implement or it's a different type of medical device. But in doing so, Ivera focuses too narrowly on the preferred embodiment. Their commercial product relates to a lure-activated valve for an intravenous catheter. The claims, however, are not so limited. The claims don't go to a cleaning device for a medical implement. They're much broader than that. The title of the patent is a cleaning device for a medical implement. In fact, the specification describes medical implement as any tool or object that can be used in a medical setting. It gives numerous examples, including access ports on tubing, access ports on catheters, needle-free valves, stopcocks, lure connectors, and even stethoscopes. That's the area of the invention. That's the area of the prior art that we need to look to. Not just the very narrow lure-activated valves for intravenous catheters that is the subject of the commercial embodiment.
What was the stage of the claim construction at the time of this motion?
Claim construction was already resolved, Your Honor.
And does it include all of the variables that you've just recited?
Yes, my recollection is that the term medical implement was not a term that was construed specifically by the court or was not requested to be construed by the court, but the patent specification very clearly states that that's what the term means.
I wasn't asking about the specification. I was asking if there had been a formal claim construction as to what's meant by vent, the second vent.
Oh, by vent. Yes, there was. The term vent does not actually appear in the claims. It's called second opening means.
Or opening.
And the judge determined that that means a vent.
Right. Well, you just recited a whole list of things, stopcocks and so on. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that those were construed as included?
Those were construed as included in the term medical implement. The vent is in the cap that goes on to the medical implement.
Okay, I'm trying to understand your argument about the breadth of the claim.
Okay. The claims refer to a cleaning device for a medical implement. And then they go on to describe that the cleaning device has various features, including a first opening and a second opening. In Ivera's making their argument about the prior art, they're trying to very, very narrowly focus on caps for lure-activated valves with intravenous catheters. But the caps that are claimed go to a broader subject matter than just lure-activated valves for intravenous catheters. The caps can go on any medical implement. And so when you interpret the term medical implement in the claim to which the cap is applied, the term is much broader than the lure-activated valves of the commercial embodiment of the Ivera.
Unlimited, you're saying, by any of the claim limitations?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Such as... I'm really trying to understand this argument, which seems to be curious to me, that you're saying the claims are so broad that they are tainted.
Well, they're not so broad that they're tainted. The issue is that Ivera seems to limit the relevant prior art or limit the analysis of the prior art to only that which is directed to lure-activated valves or intravenous catheters. They ignore or want to disregard Chinloy, for example, because they say that it relates to a different medical implement.
So are you saying that when the patentee says that the district court erred in not considering the secondary considerations, that the breadth of comparison should have included all of these other medical devices?
I was speaking more specifically about the basic obviousness issue, not getting into the secondary considerations. On secondary considerations, our argument is that the comparison is not with any of the prior art devices. The comparison that they're making and the comparison that they rely on is with regard to simple swabbing of the end of a device, not to a cap, as that may have been. I'm sorry, I may not be following the question.
Yes, I hear what you're saying, but I did not have the impression that there were caps to be compared with that were the same but for the second opening, for example. The comparison was interesting and, if valid, quite powerful. If until this device came along, you had to swab these tips mm-hmm. in order to disinfect them. And the difference now was as dramatic, to use the word that we're told is shown by these data. Then I'm trying to understand the contrary argument, because, as you know, we have a fair number of cases which direct the decision maker to look and see how a device was received sure. in the community
sure.
as being, like we have a case that says it can be the most powerful evidence of unobviousness.
In this case, Your Honor, the cap sold well. There's no dispute about that. But what Ivera fails to do is to tie that, develop a nexus of that success to the claimed features, and specifically to the venting or the second opening means.
Well, our cases, it's true that they are fact-dependent, but the statute requires that the invention as a whole be considered.
Yes, Your Honor. And even the invention as a whole, Ivera fails to make any connection between the invention as a whole and the commercial set of the unexpected results.
I don't understand this argument. Now, are you saying that once the invention issued, that there was more swabbing that happened in the industry, and that's why there was less infections, or that's why there was commercial success for the cap?
No, that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that prior to the Curos cap being commercially introduced, swabbing was the primary method of cleaning the end of the fluoroactivated okay. valve. In fact, as of today, it still is the primary method of cleaning the end of a fluoroactivated valve in hospitals. What they are saying is that the evidence shows that there is an increase, or rather a decrease, in bloodstream infections after the cap was used. That could be attributed to a lot of things. It could be attributed to... Is that a fact question?
Yes.
The underlying issue is a fact question, Your Honor, yes. And they have not put in any evidence to show that it's not. With regard to secondary considerations, and Ivera relies on so-called expert reports, submitted two expert reports, and relies on a number of other declarations. What Ivera fails to point out is that it devoted one sentence in its entire summary judge brief to the issue of secondary considerations. And that sentence was simply, look to these two expert reports. The two expert reports were very conclusory and didn't cite to any...
The district court, in deciding summary judgment, looks at the evidence on the record, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Your Honor. Not just decide based on argument made in a brief.
No.
Are you saying that the district court did not have to look at the declarations because counsel referred to them in one sentence?
Well, no, Your Honor. There's two issues there. There are expert reports and there are declarations. There are several declarations that were originally filed in the patent office during reexamination of the patent. And those declarations were cited to the court with some other briefing prior to the summary judgment briefing, 6 months before any of the summary judgment briefs were filed. Those declarations were not referred to as part of the summary judgment briefing. They were not referred to in the expert reports, and they were not referred to in Ivera's briefs. Only on appeal now has Ivera resurrected those declarations and said, Your Honor, the judge and district court should have gone back through the record, should have looked to some briefing 6 months ago and realized we submitted these.
So they are part of the record.
They're part of the record of the case, yes.
And as far as I can tell, you did not object to them when they were introduced into the record.
When they were introduced into the record. That's correct, Your Honor.
So you're stuck with them.
Yes.
Why don't those declarations raise a genuine issue of material fact?
They don't raise a genuine issue of material fact because the basic evidence of obviousness is so strong. Even if you have a strong showing of secondary considerations of non-obviousness, a clear showing of obviousness cannot be overcome by that. Here, with what is admitted to be undisputed in the record, there's a clear showing of obviousness. And no matter what is said in those declarations, we recognize that they're part of the record, and we're not pointing them out that they're not. It's not enough to overcome the clear showing of obviousness.
You got four declarations, and they all go to the issue of motivation. Isn't that part of a prima facie case?
It's part of a prima facie case, yes. It's just one of the many things that are considered as part of that case.
Can you remind me, did you argue in your red brief that the declarations that were in the record but perhaps not referred to in Ivera's opposition to summary judgment cannot be relied on to defend, to challenge the summary judgment ruling? That's essentially a procedural argument, that it's not enough for something to be in the record. It actually has to have been relied on by the opponent of summary judgment in the summary judgment opposition, and that was not done here. Is that an argument that's in your red brief?
We did make that argument, yes, Your Honor. And I don't recall the page site, but I know that there were several cases where that has been the case, where there was one case, I can remember the name of it. There was one case where the declarations that were in a very similar situation were submitted 4 days from the time the summary judgment briefs were submitted. And in that case, this court found that they should not be relied upon as part of the analysis. And that is the In re Blaso Corp case, where there was a 4-day difference. Here we have 6 months difference from the time that the declarations were submitted to the court from when the summary judgment briefing occurred. And it's much more than the 4 days we saw in Blaso.
Any
Your
more
Honor,
questions?
See,
any more questions for Mr. Hess?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Okay. Mr. Gross?
Your Honor, if I may, I'm just going to give record sites. That's all I'm going to do. I'm going to start with the four declarants at A1062, before the district court, counsel below named names. Name said that's what Mr. Buckman says, Morrison says, Huang says, and Lensing says. So the district court clearly had fully understood that the four declarants were part of that record with respect to motivation to combine. I now want to switch to secondary factors. And Judge Toronto, I was trying to find the Menahay site. I can't find it. I will just cite that in the record at A.
You just spell that word.
The answer is no, but I can find it for the court. It's Menhay within a few letters.
Okay.
Two other things quickly. You did talk about, the court asked about an example on page A5343. It talks about Mr. Buckman's cap, and taking the court's point that it's not directly about a medical cap, but it's close. The phrase there is, Dr. Buckman's cap was never commercialized because it's extremely complex design and resulting high maintenance cost. And that's one of the references that they talk about in the briefing. So it's close, Your Honor. And then finally, this is very important. In terms of what was right before the court that the court referred to in the decision. So this was argued at the summary judgment and in the decision. There's two reports, Lensing and then also Kennedy. Kennedy at A5658 goes through the sales and talks about how it goes from 0 to 300,000 to 10 million to 100 million. So the sales of the claimed invention are in the record right before the court, argued at the summary judgment hearing, in the briefing, and cited. There's no issue about whether that was cited to the district court. And then Lensing at page 5622 and 5623 discusses long-felt need in detail and unexpected results in detail. So we're not in a situation where we're lost without the earlier declaration from Mr. Rogers. We're in a situation where even setting aside the Mr. Rogers declaration that was in the record and we think should be relied on, we had the core information. When you look at all that in light and what favorable to us, we believe it means that under the proper precedent of this court, we should have a chance to have a jury find all these disputed facts and not have the court throw the case out. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gross. And again, Mr. Hess, the case is taken under submission. That concludes the argued cases for this morning.